It all began for me in a small conference room on the 10th floor of the United Nations skyscraper building. There were six of us there, reporters, photographers, cameramen, broadcasters, the chosen six. We had been selected to see tomorrow. We were being briefed for a three-month journey by the seventh man in the room, the man at the head of the table.
It's a fascinating assignment, gentlemen. I may say that I envy you.
A journey to Latin America.
Your assignment is to tell the story of how this technical assistance program is working. But more than that, to see what people are doing to improve their lives and how those lives are affected by the efforts of their government and of the United Nations.
And that was our assignment. We saw tomorrow. A United Nations story about a journey to Latin America. The man who actually did the traveling was Emil Corwin, who also made the recordings and wrote the story. Now, Leo Genn steps into his shoes and tells you how we saw tomorrow. Mexico, El Salvador, Colombia, Ecuador, Bolivia, Peru, Chile, Brazil. 8 republics, 112 million people. An area 60 times that of Britain, more than twice the size of China. You know, this kind of journey, a journey on a radio program, has one important advantage over really having to move across the Earth's surface. We can dispense with paperwork, customs duties, visas, shopping expeditions, unpleasant inoculations for all sorts of strange diseases. We don't need to bother with the long waits at airports, the language confusions, the misunderstandings, none of that. We just pick ourselves up and set ourselves down anywhere we like on the 25,000-mile route. And so we choose Colorines in Mexico. The skyscrapers are behind us. Here we have the adobe huts of much of the Mexican countryside. The people here have a harder life. The ground is mean and hard. It yields nothing without great effort. We have come to Ixtapatango, one of 7 great power plants in the Miguel Alemán power system. There are green hills all about us, and the sturdy silver penstocks are gilded in the late afternoon sun. Our guide explains...
This is one of 7 such plants, which provide a great proportion of the electrical energy to drive the mines and the farms of Mexico. The system is now being expanded through loans from the International Bank for Reconstruction and Development, working with the Mexican government.
We now go to the little community called Colorines, a small electric city whose entire existence is linked to the energy of falling water. If you've ever been to a hydroelectric plant, you may have been struck by the extreme simplicity of the whole thing. Seems more like a hospital than a factory. Large windows, clear modern walls, a few control boards, a handful of white-coated duty engineers, and the sound... Well, not really much more than a steady, low hum. The community itself, not far away, is like an alpine resort beside a lake. However, the lake is man-made by the people of Colorines. One of its citizens is Ramon Mendoza Sierra.
How long have you been here?
I've been here 14 years.
And you've been in Colorines 14 years?
Colorines 14 years.
Well, when did the Federal Power Commission start to build their hydroelectric project here?
I think they started the work on the 5th of May, 1938.
We are told the project was started by engineers and inexperienced laborers who worked under incredible hardship. They went without food, slept on bare ground, and used primitive equipment to dig through mud and clay for the foundations. And then later on, when an avalanche let loose by a cloudburst threatened to destroy months of effort, the men set to work for 20 days and nights without a stop.
How was it at that time? Can you describe the town
at
that time?
It was no town at all. just hills and swamps, river, that's all.
And now it's been converted into this very beautiful community with a lake surrounded by these beautiful green mountains.
Yes, sir.
Landscaped with hibiscus trees. I noticed a beautiful red and yellow hibiscus. And birds on the porch. Lovely dining room.
Plenty of those things here.
I noticed the social hall there, too, for the workers.
Oh, yes. They go in there every night and enjoy themselves, playing dominoes and passing the time after hours.
I was interested, Mr. Mendoza, in knowing how many people are there here now?
We're around 3,000 or more.
3,000?
Three or more.
And 14 years ago, there was nobody here.
There was nobody here.
From a river and a swamp to a living community. Out of nothing, something. That something is light and energy and power. We can see how Mexico, with the help of loans from the United Nations World Bank, is stringing this electric power out to the farms, homes, and industries of Mexico. My colleagues start working. Photographs, notes, questions. And when this is finished, and we're about to leave, there is music from the shores of the lake. For these three men, this is a day off. On 6 days out of seven, they are makers of power. Today, they make quiet music. It would be pleasant to spend a little more time at Colorinas among the hibiscus and the hills. But the wings of time are spread, and we are already almost 1,500 miles to the south, in the ranges of the Andes, with Bogota as the destination.
Are you quite comfortable, sir?
Yes, thank you very much. But can you please explain what this device is, this thing with the blue rubber tube?
It's the oxygen equipment. That's the control, and that's the tube you put in your mouth.
But I feel perfectly well, thank you.
You may need it later on. This stage takes us up to 20,000 feet. Why, Quito is 11,000 feet above sea level.
Oh, I don't think I'll need the oxygen, thank you. I'll go to sleep. A little smug and entirely wrong. A glance to my neighbor, whose oxygen tube is already in his mouth. Sleep. The plane climbs, but no sleep. Chest feels heavy. Head swimming a bit. Light-headed quality. Awareness of great pressures. Outward, somehow. All very strange. Surrender. Reach for the oxygen tube. The cool draft down my throat feels very, very good. When the black spots before the eyes lift, the scene is something like I've imagined a spaceship to be. All the passengers have blue tubes in their mouths. The stewardess is making her rounds in a mask, carrying an oxygen tank underneath her arm. Clearly, we're about to land on the moon. But we land instead at Cusco, which is 11,000 feet above sea level, and quite high enough. Cusco, the sacred city of the Incas, plundered by Spanish invaders, the oldest continuously inhabited city in the Western Hemisphere. On the drive to the hotel through the narrow cobblestone streets, there are reminders of an event in Cusco's recent history, the earthquake that devastated the city in May 1950. The rubble had not yet been cleared when experts from the United Nations and the specialized agencies arrived to map out a construction program.
Our time in Cusco is too limited to see all of these projects, so we decide to concentrate on a serious health problem, typhus. We have a talk with Dr. Gustavo Hermosa, in charge of the anti-typhus program being carried out in the area in cooperation with the World Health Organization and UNICEF.
In this area, in 1948, there were 739 cases of typhus. In 1951, only 99. This big drop is due to our DDT spraying campaign.
What exactly does the DDT do, Doctor?
It kills the body lice which carry typhus. When you kill the lice, you reduce the incidence of the disease.
Do the people like to be dusted with DDT? Is there any problem there?
In some communities, DDT teams have had to overcome fear and prejudice. But in this area, we have had good cooperation. If you would like to see a DDT team in action, come along with us to Pisac, an Indian town not very far from here.
The arrival of our station wagon bearing the DDT team is an occasion for music and dancing. Men in wigs, dance masks, and colorful costumes shuffle solemnly around the village square while the local musicians provide the music, an ancient ceremony of welcome. But soon the old ritual ends. The scientific ritual begins.
I am standing now inside an Indian home in Pisac as the UNICEF chief is coming in to inform the people that the DDT unit is about to enter the home. It's a very colorful courtyard, pottery about, straw baskets, and Indians sitting down. They're wearing ponchos and a curious type hat.
While the UNICEF man explains the process to the villagers, the equipment is offloaded from the car.
Typhus is transmitted by lice, and since the application of DDT, the people here call it the sleeping powder because it enables them to sleep. Oh, here comes the DDT man now, dressed in the green parachute costume with a white bag of the powder over his back and his squirt gun under his arm. Now the DDT men are at work with their squirt guns. He is putting the gun, the nozzle of the gun, down the shirt of one of the Indians, front and back, squirting it way down, has a long nozzle. Now down the sleeve, he's holding his arm up. Everybody's lining up, very happy to have this treatment. Well, we're getting a nice spray of white powder over this way as the wind carries the powder in this direction.
To each house in the village go the green men, the sprayers, dressed in their green silk overalls. We brush the DDT dust off our hair and clothes, collect the equipment, and climb back in the UNICEF station wagon. There are new sights, new sounds in the old Inca hills. They are nearer than ever before to the great world outside. Goodbye, Peru, and good luck. We are leaving Cusco, the sacred city, by train, the first we've taken in South America. 11 hours after leaving Cusco, the train arrives at Lake Titicaca, highest navigable lake in the world. At the quayside, there is moored what looks like a liner, the Atlanta, a trim white steamer of considerable size. She was built in Scotland, brought to Peru in sections, transported across the Andes, and pieced together on the lake. The overnight journey on the lake is calm. In the morning, we wake for a deckside view of an inland sea, a sea miles above sea level. The snow-capped mountains rimming the lake are glowing pink in the rising sun. The water is cobalt blue and calm. We set foot for the first time in Bolivia, a landlocked mountain republic. onto another train bound for the capital. As it rumbles along the bleak altiplano, or highland, we find ourselves at the rim of a canyon. At the bottom, 1,400 feet below us, yet still 12,000 feet above sea level, lies the red-roofed city of La Paz. A few days later, we are up at 5 in the morning. Mr. Deletre has arrived, and Mr. Laroche. Pierre Deletre is a Frenchman. Roger Laroche is from Belgium. Both are in Bolivia on behalf of the United Nations Technical Assistance Administration in answer to a specific request of the United Nations from the Bolivian government. They are specialists upon certain phases of tin mining. It is still dark as we arrive at the railway station and board a most curious conveyance called the Autocarril. This vehicle is to take us to Oruro, home of the San Jose tin mine. The Autocarril has the body of a limousine and the chassis of a small locomotive, with a cow catcher and steel wheels. The man at the controls is not an engine driver, but a chauffeur. We arrive on time at the San Jose mine and get dressed for the descent.
We are now standing in the pit, ready to descend below to see them mine the tin ore. The five of us are dressed in miners' outfits, wearing bright yellow oilskin coats, miners' helmets, and equipped with acetylene torches, shooting a thin yellow flame.
We crowd into the mine lift. Pierre Deletre gives the signal. The descent begins.
We are now going down in the mine lift. There are four of us squeezed in a small mine shaft lift, and it is very dark, very humid. Mr. Deletre, how far down are we going to descend?
About 215 meters.
We're going down 215 meters, which is approximately 600 and some odd feet. I'm already perspiring in this outfit. It must be very hot working down there.
Not so, you know. It's a question of practice.
Yes.
I do that for 30 years, you know.
Well, I know you're an old veteran at it.
Yes, and my father.
And your grandfather.
My grandfather, my great-grandfather did the same. Please, look at it.
Ah.
Below, you know.
Light is coming through below. That's right. We are still descending silently and slowly in the darkness down the mine shaft of the San Jose mine. We have now reached the 100-meter level.
At the 215-meter level, we grope with Pierre Deletre along a hot, dark tunnel.
How would you describe this particular station we're at now?
Now, you know, it's a bin in order to load the skips.
This is a loading station.
Loading station.
I see.
The 215 meters loading station.
This is where the ore is mined higher up and is allowed to fall by its own gravity. So you see, they can load the trucks here automatically.
Oh, it saves a lot of work.
It saves a lot of work. And he pointed out that the man who works here is a very good job because he's paid higher, although actually he works less.
Mr. Deletre explains how the galleries are ventilated by a compressed air network. Those are the sounds we hear constantly.
We've walked over a considerable distance of track over which the loading cars travel, much of the way in thick mud.
Mr. Deletre, what is that noise I hear up above?
That was in order to take out the ore.
It was an explosion.
It was an explosion, yes.
What, a dynamite?
Dynamite, yes.
Can we get out of here quickly?
No, 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 you are safe. You are safe.
So says Mr. Deletre. Not completely reassured, we follow him. I bang my head against an overhead beam. I slip in the mud. We're all perspiring like mad. After another hour of this, the party is somewhat relieved to find itself standing at the entrance to the lift.
That bell was a telephone to the surface to see about the lift.
And as we wait for it...
It's interesting to recall that the basic economy of Bolivia is its mineral wealth, and tin is the most important of its minerals. Tin accounts for 70% of Bolivian exports,
And this mine, which is one of the richest tin mines in Bolivia, has been going for a good many years.
We ask Pierre a question. Have you seen any improvements in mining operations since you came on the job?
Actuellement, ils sont arrivés non pas à doubler entièrement la production, mais à l'avoir augmenté de 80%.
Some of the work you saw here represents a production increase of 80%. I don't claim credit for myself. We of the United Nations suggest ways to improve mine production and processing of mineral products. It's the Bolivian engineers who carry out the work. We work together. But Pierre's modesty prevents him from telling the whole story. Because of his effort, a dozen important mining operations have been streamlined and made more economical, and a high degree of cooperation has been reached between mines belonging to different and competing companies. It is cold and dark as the autocarrier speeds back across the desolate plateau on the return trip to La Paz. In the darkness, our thoughts turn to Pierre de Lettre and his colleagues. They are men whose special knowledge and whose capacity to transplant it have brought them invitations from far distant lands. They are typical of this United Nations group in Bolivia, working together to help a landlocked republic improve its way of life. We cross the last of the Cordilleras, our airliner gliding high over the foothills. Miles below, the tributaries of the Amazon started ascending, slowly at first, thin silver veins set in the dense green of the tropical forest. Then gathering momentum in number and intensity, broadening out almost suddenly into the great massive flood of the world's biggest river. On endlessly over the interminable green jungle, choking with life there far below, until even that immensity began yielding to man. We turn southwest towards the plateau. The first clearings, the first frontier settlements, the roads, the gleam of the first railway line, the coffee bushes of the plateau, the great bustling city of San Paulo with its skyscrapers and its commerce. It was in this great busy metropolis that we found the most peaceful and yet the most moving story of all our journey. A terrace in the open garden of a large suburban house, a broad shady tree, its branches forming a protective canopy, a warm summer afternoon. Children in the garden. Not just ordinary children. They hardly speak at all. We are visiting Brazil's Society for Help to Crippled Children. Our guide is the society's director, Dr. Renato da Costa Bomim. He asks each child to give her name and address.
Dirce Lourenço.
Dirce Lourenço. Onde é que você mora?
Em Bauru.
Bauru, interior de São Paulo.
Não, na capital.
E você, de onde vem?
Salto Grande.
Salto Grande. Onde é? No interior?
Dr. Bomim explains.
The programs for rehabilitation of crippled children are quite a new field in Brazil. Here the children have physiotherapy, occupational therapy. They are learning primary education and being prepared for later on to be on their own.
To help in this work, the United Nations has sent out to Brazil Miss Celestine Igo, who has done much work in physical rehabilitation, and whose special skill lies in organizing schools of this kind. Miss Igo, who is constantly beside Dr. Bomim, tells us some more.
This is vacation time here, and these 14 children are children who remain with us during the vacation period, and we hope that they are having a good time. They are at least not being confined in their classrooms and sewing and knitting and doing artwork that they have to do during the regular school time.
They're mostly from poor homes, are they?
They are mostly from poor homes, and most of them are from homes of farmers and poor people who are trying to make a living out in an undeveloped part of the country.
Miss Igo, these children on wheelchairs, could you tell me what the trouble with each of them is?
Well, let's see. Over here, we have a polio, yeah. And then in plain English, the next one is what we call a brittle bone, and then we have a muscular dystrophy and a polio, and this is a congenital case. And Dearcy here is a polio. She's a Pott's disease, the little girl over there, which is a TB spine. This is a peculiar case, and I guess she just called her a congenital.
Little girl here.
This little girl right here.
With a doll between her feet.
With a doll between her feet that she's guarding very, very carefully that no one takes. And the other two children are polios.
There's a little girl there with a doll on her lap falling asleep, poor kid.
And then Dr. Balmeem asks if we'd like to hear the children sing. And out there, in the garden at San Paolo, under the shade of the great tree, the little voices, one by one, come to life. No time, no time again. Brazil, with its 55 million people, its immense capacities, its land surface greater than the USA, its dozens of worthwhile United Nations projects, all these must be left behind. Stories to be told another time. For we have moved rapidly 2,500 miles to the southwest. We are in Lota, a mining town in the south of Chile. Here there are singing children too, but the song is different. So is the will to sing. Listen. This is the Isadora Casino School. The classroom walls are covered with pictures of fish, paintings, drawings, even poems on themes to do with fish. And this song, called Coplas Pescado, translates roughly as follows. Fish is a great food of very high value. I cook it myself, and I cook it with steam. Little fish, by no means delay. We want you quite fresh, little fish, from the net.